Welcome to the Multicultural Middle Ages podcast. My name is Reed O'Mara, and today I'll be hosting this episode on uncovering the forgotten frescoes of medieval Bohemia with Isabel Chisholm. Isabel, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hello. Hi, Reed. Thank you for having me. My name is Isabel Chisholm, and I'm a medieval art historian who specializes in the art of Central Europe and predominantly the Bohemian Kingdom.
Perfect. Welcome to the podcast. And it's great that you've already said what your specialty is, because that's exactly what we're talking about. And I think a great place to start with any topic is just explaining what you mean, right? So can you begin by telling us what you mean by medieval Bohemia? Where is this region? That kind of thing.
Yes, of course. So medieval Bohemia has actually come to be considered a rather controversial and artificial phrase because of the changing geographical borders of Central Europe from the Middle Ages to the present day. In today's episode, we'll primarily be focusing on the 14th century, which encompasses the transition from the Przemyslid dynasty to the crown lands of Bohemia and the Holy Roman Empire during the reign of Charles IV after his coronation in 1347. At the beginning of the 14th century, the Przemyslid dynasty had control over the regions of modern-day Czechia, along with the Margraviate of Meissen and additional northeastern areas such as Upper Silesia and Poland, extending all the way up to the Baltic Sea. Then Charles IV ascended the throne in the mid-14th century, succeeding his father John, Count of Luxembourg, and by 1355 he was crowned King of Italy and Holy Roman Emperor. Once he was crowned King of Burgundy in 1365, he ruled all the kingdoms of the Holy Roman Empire, so the territory was changed once again. Today, when people refer to Bohemia, they often mean the northwestern part of Czechia, which includes Prague, the capital. But in the 14th century, the southeastern so-called Moravian area of the country was also considered a part of the Bohemian crown lands, as well as the other regions I just mentioned. Historiographically speaking, it is interesting to consider the evolution of Central European borders to understand the political context in which art historians were writing about Bohemian medieval art, particularly in the 19th and 20th centuries. What we now refer to as Czechia was once part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire from 1867. In 1918, the first Czechoslovak Republic was founded as they gained independence. But by 1939, Nazi troops began their occupation, and the end of the Second World War was swiftly followed by Soviet communist rule. It was only after the Velvet Revolution and the fall of the Iron Curtain in 1989 that Czechoslovakia regained autonomy. Then in the 1990s, Czechoslovakia split into the Czech Republic and Slovakia.
So what we're dealing with here is a region that has no real fixed borders. Depending on what time period you're looking at, it might be include more parts north, more parts east, more parts south, that kind of thing. So thank you so much for outlining actually what we mean by medieval Bohemia. But I'm wondering if we could talk a little bit more about the timeline of the frescoes specifically and where they are.
Yes, of course. So when it comes to the timeline about the frescoes that we'll specifically be talking about today, they were all completed in the 14th century. And in this episode, the case studies that we will explore all fall within the borders of present-day Czechia.
Now, when we talk about frescoes, let's also define that, because I think it can mean a lot of different things. There's a lot of different words used for this, be they murals, wall paintings, this kind of thing. So can you explain to listeners why this is such a unique medium and what making a medieval fresco entails?
Yes, so frescoes are wall paintings that are made with an underlying layer of wet plaster. The idea is that the paint that is applied on top penetrates through the plaster, leaving a lasting image on the wall's surface. This medium uniquely unites both two-dimensional and three-dimensional form by literally fusing art, painting, and architecture. Compared to other medieval artworks, such as altarpieces or sculptures, frescoes are not easily movable. Most of the time, they remain part of their original architectural setting, despite the fluctuating borders surrounding what was once medieval Bohemia. The medieval churches I have investigated remain within their original geographic location. The changing political alignments of this region throughout the 19th and 20th centuries that I spoke about earlier often fostered nationalistic art historical discourses, with more portable art objects often being hijacked and taken to other museums or institutions to be claimed as another nation's cultural heritage. Although the unchanged location of the frescoes in question could also spark nationalistic debates, I believe that viewing these artworks in the context of their intact ecclesiastical settings can open up new and interesting research avenues. In terms of the global Middle Ages, I aim to view these churches as microcosms for wider transcultural trends concerning iconography and ritual. Frescoes especially allowed me to examine the relationship between medieval art, architecture, and ceremony in a more holistic manner and address associated historiographical complexities.
Yes, this is absolutely great. And I think you've touched on a lot of things we're going to talk about today. It is really special that these frescoes are actually still in situ and that you can view them in obviously a changed context, but still something of the original context. But you've touched a little bit here on these issues of nationalism and national identity. And so I think here we should dive a little bit more into this historiographical debate. And I'm curious if it's something that actually initially attracted you to studying these medieval frescoes.
I think that the historiographical debates concerning medieval Bohemian frescoes are certainly intriguing and offer insight into the extent to which a socio-political climate can affect art historical scholarship. When it comes to the region of present-day Czechia, I believe there was a continuous suppressed desire to assert an independent national identity whilst various political powers competed for influence throughout the 20th century. And earlier, the imperial rhetoric of the Austro-Hungarian Empire arguably affected the scholarship of the Vienna School of Art History as well. The frescoes in Czechia that are perhaps the most extensively studied are those decorating the 12th century rotunda in Znojmo, in more of the southern region in Moravia. This town had a strong German influence despite being in Moravia, a Slavic territory of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And in particular, the iconography of the ploughing scene and standing rulers in the enigmatic zones within the rotunda were the main point of controversy, because the idiosyncrasy of the imagery only magnified the impact of cultural biases on art historical interpretation. So I think that's a very interesting example that sort of sparked this interest in the specific role of frescoes within this historiographical debate of nationalism versus globalization. And in the latter 20th century, the period of Charles IV's reign, I believe, came to be seen as a kind of golden age for artistic production. And it was often presented, whether that's intentionally or inadvertently, as the precursor to the future independent Czechoslovak or Czech state. And this is perhaps one of the reasons why so much scholarship on medieval frescoes and other artworks continues to be centered on Prague or areas around the city's vicinity. And whilst this material is important, I was interested in addressing this bias, and I wanted to highlight the importance of other more remote medieval churches throughout the country.
Brilliant. Yes. I think whenever, be it art historians or some other type of field, whenever we encounter the phrase golden age, I always get that bell that goes off that goes, I don't know. I don't know about this. Or something with a center, like, oh, it's always Prague or it's always Paris, Cologne, whatever it is. These also cause alarm bells to go off where I go, let's investigate that. So I think it's really great that your research aims to highlight so-called hidden frescoes or these ones that are not at the quote-unquote center that has been established by scholarship. And so can you tell us how you actually discovered these hidden frescoes throughout Czechia? And I know you have some interesting anecdotes about this, so I would love to hear some of them, and I know the listeners would as well.
Yes, for sure, for sure. So it all began with some black and white photographs that I found of frescoes online whilst I was specifically researching the iconography of the Dormition of the Virgin. I started to make a long list in my notebook of the various locations of these frescoes listed in the captions. And then I called up my friend and asked if she fancied going on a road trip around the country, and she agreed, and we planned our route and set off in the summer. It's funny because the frescoes that looked the best in the photos online actually ended up being more underwhelming in person in comparison to the frescoes from the lower quality photos that often did not even capture all the contours of the imagery. It was only by physically visiting these frescoes that I could properly understand them, both on the basic level of being able to observe their actual appearance in colour rather than black and white. Also, the experiences of walking through their three-dimensional setting prompted me to consider them as an architectural phenomenon, not just artificially collapsed into two-dimensional form with their surroundings cropped out of the frame, but a part of a wider context. For example, one of the churches that I visited, the Church of St. James the Great in Slavětín in northwest Czechia, I had only seen some very dark and blurry black and white photos of one fresco segment on one of its interior walls. But when we arrived, we came face to face with a vast space, almost the size of a cathedral, with high walls covered completely from floor to ceiling with lavish multicoloured wall paintings. What is shocking is that for centuries, these sorts of intricate fresco cycles were whitewashed, and many churchgoers who still used these ecclesiastical spaces as local parishes had no idea what lay behind these wall surfaces. Whilst visiting another church in Černý at the opposite end of Czechia in the southeast, just north of Brno, I got in contact with the parish priest, and he told me to look for a greenhouse behind the church when I arrived, as that was where Mrs. Fafilková lived, and she was the one who had the key to open it for me. And I began to chat with her when we entered the church together, and she told me about how her family had been attending this parish church throughout her childhood. And one day, one of the whitewashed walls started to peel at its edge behind the altar, and her father noticed. And then he and other members of the town and clergy began to peel back this white layer of paint to find some of the most magnificent and also some of the oldest medieval frescoes of the area. Week after week, the locals would attend services in this parish churches, and little did they know that they were so close to some of the oldest medieval frescoes in the country until they were finally uncovered, in this case, in the 1960s.
Absolutely incredible. I mean, just that they were there the whole time. And it's not as though the church had fallen into ruin or that people weren't using it. Like they're still using the space and they're just right there. So, what an incredible story. And I love these anecdotes because, for our listeners, this is being a medievalist, I feel like. It's, oh, finding the person who has the key to that random parish church and then has all of this lore about, oh, we found this in the attic and, oh, and we peeled the paint off. And I mean, that's absolutely incredible. Just thinking through that a lot of these things are probably just like this covered, but that maybe in some ways the plaster, although I'm sure it probably did bring some damage to the murals, in some ways it probably also protected them. You never know, right? And actually, I think one of the other things that this taps into is, as an art historian, the role of photography in doing our work, and also about the limits of photography. If you only have black and white photos, or you only have the singular shot of the space. As someone who's worked quite a bit on architectural sculpture, you encounter this a lot where you don't understand the scale of a sculpture or a portal, or you get there and you realize things are really actually next to each other in ways you hadn't realized, and they really have visual echoes. And I know this is something that Jacqueline Young has written about quite a bit, with the way that people move through space actually gets lost in a lot of limited photography. And she's tried to recreate that with, you know, having multiple images in her books and articles. Let's talk about these issues of preservation and also photography.
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting point to bring up, because often wall paintings from the medieval era are assumed to be books for the illiterate, and because they could supposedly illustrate the written text of the Bible and disseminate its message to a wider audience. However, when we consider the fact that lots of wall paintings actually contained written text, and that they often lacked comprehensive narrative accounts central to fundamental Christian doctrine, this hypothesis starts to crumble. And I think, as you mentioned, this kind of segmentation of imagery through the medium of photography sort of lulls you into the false sense of security that everything belongs to a progressive narrative, when that really wasn't the case.
Yeah, definitely. And also with the photography, aside from the issues of creating a progressive narrative, you've touched about color. I mean, these frescoes, maybe you can describe some of the color. We'll go into a specific one soon, but the photography showed you that one fresco, you know, was going to be absolutely incredible. And then you get there and it's a little underwhelming, right? Or the opposite. The photography is terrible. And then you get there and you're like, oh my God, the color, the scale.
Exactly. I definitely experienced that sense of surprise visiting a few of these places. I think what's also interesting, though, is that colour can be deceptive, because when I visited the church in Slaviatin that I mentioned that had these really big, lavish paintings more in the northwest, I thought, oh, this is amazing. They've preserved so much here. It's still so vibrant. But then when I started to look more closely, I realized that there was also a lot of perhaps less sensitive conservation that went into that particular site compared to another church that I visited, that even though the contours themselves, you know, were not as clearly outlined, they were still more authentic to the original color palette or composition to the best that they could be, compared to the other place where you had these quite thick black outlines, and it sort of gave you that feeling that it was very finished and that a lot had survived, but in fact it was overpainting and it kind of covered up a lot of perhaps the nuances that would have otherwise been visible.
I think a lot of people don't realize there are many different approaches to preservation and conservation. And those things might be very different, right? Preservation versus conservation. And also that, of course, the technology of both changes over time. What you're able to accomplish changes, but also what the goals are. For some people at certain time periods, it's about creating a complete picture based on what survives, right? So filling in things so that it looks complete, so it can still function aesthetically within an actual being still used ecclesiastical space. Or it might be something where you don't want people to think that everything is medieval or that it's a complete image. So you might fill in, sometimes it's called aqua sporca, like you might fill in the losses with like this gray area so that the losses are evident to the viewer. And I'm sure as art historians, we have lots of thoughts about what is better, what's worse. But I mean, thinking through these different preservation techniques and things that have been overpainted, things that were eventually covered with plaster and then revealed, I think this actually brings us back in a way to the nationalistic biases that have, perhaps the word to use is plagued scholarship. You mentioned that you want to move past nationalistic biases based on modern geographic borders when you approach these medieval frescoes. So how do you hope to do this? Or really, how are you doing this? Because this is your work. I know you're doing it.
Well, I think that, to put it simply, focusing on the interior space as opposed to exterior space. So really taking the church as a what I call microcosm, a small local space that speaks to wider global trends or wider regional trends. And frescoes are particularly interesting because they cannot be disconnected from their three-dimensional form, and also not just that, but it takes it a step further because they can't be disconnected from their ritual space. I've spoken a bit about how they're connected to the architecture. So when it comes to that, I wanted to look at the ways that every placement of a fresco was intentional. And specifically, when I was focusing on the Dormition of the Virgin, which is quite a, it's not as well known as, for example, scenes like the Annunciation, or the Nativity, or the Adoration of the Magi, that kind of thing. So I wanted to explore, why is it so prevalent in Central Europe? And why is it so prevalent in wall painting? And could I use the actual environment in which they're painted to answer that question? So why was the Dormition placed in this part of the church as opposed to another part? Why was it placed next to this other scene? Does it relate to it? I wanted to look at fresco cycles as part of a whole, that they were in a way a larger three-dimensional painting that was all part of one piece, not just individual pieces spliced together, but actually all one piece that could not fit into the lens of a camera, but was still united somehow. That was the assumption that I came in with. And then when it comes to ritual, I wanted to look at the frescoes in relation to the various partitionings of church space. So we have the nave area, but then we also have the chancel area behind the altar. And these ideas of liminality versus access start to come into play. Who was allowed behind the altar? Who would have been able to see the wall paintings behind the altar up close? And who wouldn't be able to see them? And did that affect the kind of painting they wanted to put in a certain place as opposed to another? Was there a different message that the painting was supposed to send to the clergy, or a different topic of contemplation as opposed to the laity in the nave? So these sorts of questions were what I was trying to ask myself.
And I think they're really great questions. And for me, this brings up a kind of tension. As you've used this word before, holistically, you're looking at these murals holistically, these frescoes, as part of a entire space. No fresco ends, it continues into another one. They cannot be segmented like photography would require, right? It's all one artwork in a way. And yet, at the same time, they are segmented or partitioned by ritual and by people, essentially, and these levels of access. And I think it's really great to think through who is the intended viewer. And you had mentioned before there being text in some of these, or that the iconography may be is not obvious or like difficult to parse, what it means theologically, you know, that speaks to different types of viewers, whether it's a literate member of the clergy or maybe somebody with a different level of literacy that's a lay person, whatever it may be, and who is explaining the images to them. I mean, it just goes on and on, but I think these are the really exciting questions to investigate.
I'm glad that we're on the same page about that. I think that it's always interesting to stretch the boundaries of how frescoes should be viewed, because I really didn't, I mean, maybe you're more familiar with other literature, but I didn't come across that many examples of people who did assume and give the dignity to the fresco as having a conscious organization. As we alluded to before, that could be for practical reasons when it comes to photography, or even just other academic trends before this kind of prevalence of ritual space came into being, or the idea of the multi-sensory Middle Ages.
Yeah. The word you've used too that is really sparking something for me is conscious and the idea of intentionality. And I'm wondering if we do know anything about the people who either designed or made the frescoes, whether or not those are one and the same person, or I imagine different people. But yeah, I think oftentimes people think that things just kind of happen to, like that these medieval artists and craftspeople or designers weren't thinking through things, but actually I think they were thinking quite intently about things and the way things relate to each other. And also, I mean, just materially, I mean, we haven't really talked about what the pigments are or anything, but this is not inexpensive, both in terms of pigments and in terms of labor, I mean, let alone the actual architecture. So I think intentionality, being conscious about where things are placed and how they're made, it's part of medieval art and what makes it so magical to me.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think one thing that I always think about when I'm starting a research project or something, I try to look at the subject matter from a humble perspective, not thinking that I am in a society that is more advanced than the society that I'm studying, but instead honoring it in a sense, allowing it to have the dignity that it perhaps deserves, and allowing myself to kind of be taught by what I see. I mean, all I see is just, all we have left is the physical evidence. And sometimes we don't even have that. So we have to work backwards from that point. But I think that a good mindset or approach to have as a researcher is to stay open-minded to the fact that perhaps these people were even more advanced than you are, or
Yeah, I mean, certainly more than me. But yeah, no, the idea of dignity, I think, is really important. And it's a really beautiful sentiment to approach these works from that standpoint, because yeah, they're all that survives. They're traces of a society that we have just, you know, we can glimpse, but yeah, we have to work backwards. And I think we've teased it enough. I think we should describe a fresco for the listeners, because I think they're going to want to know a little bit more in depth what it is we're talking about, because they're absolutely beautiful. And you have quite a poetic turn of phrase. So let's talk about one.
Let's jump into it. So I would like to start with a fresco that really illustrates what we've just been speaking about, this idea of the partitioning of space, the intentionality behind viewership, liminality versus access. And so the case study that I'm going to begin with is the Church of St. Nicholas in Stary Svojanov, which is located approximately 1 hour's journey north of Brno, one of the largest cities in the Czech Republic, possibly the second largest apart from Prague. There is different imagery that decorates the chancel area versus the nave area. And as we've spoken about, the chancel would have been mainly accessible to the clergy, as the mass would be performed at the altar, whereas the nave could be occupied by the laity. In St. Nicholas's church chancel, the left wall is decorated by the Dormition of the Virgin. So the Dormition of the Virgin is the iconography which depicts the Virgin Mary on her deathbed, with the apostles miraculously gathered around her. Christ is also shown receiving the Virgin's soul in the form of an infant into heaven above, signalling her transition from the earthly to the heavenly realm. The Dormition is often used as a didactic example of the ideal death in the Middle Ages, with narrative accounts appearing in texts such as the Golden Legend. The naturalism of this painting is very striking. It deviates slightly from the typical composition of the 12 apostles encircling the Virgin Mary on her deathbed, with Christ embracing her soul in the form of a baby above. Whilst each character is still present, it is set outside on a grassy plain. There is also a rather rare suggestion of motion, since the Virgin is shown being carried by the apostles on a bier, and the dark sky and shadowy blades of grass strongly imply that the scene is happening at night. The apostles hold various instruments to administer a pleasing death, such as an aspergillum, candles, and an open book, with two angels flanking the Virgin's body on either side, swinging censers. Christ crowned appears above, holding Mary's infant soul in a mandorla laced on its edge with white ribbon-like clouds signifying the heavenly realm. He wears blue robes and holds a scepter resembling the staff of Moses, with the serpent coiled at its tip, symbolizing the healing sacrifice of Christ on the cross, referenced by Jesus himself during his conversation with Nicodemus, as recorded in the Gospel of John, chapter 3, when he states, "Just as Moses lifted up the snake in the wilderness, so the Son of Man must be lifted up, that everyone who believes may have eternal life in him. For God, so meaning in this way, loved the world that he gave his one and only Son, that whoever believes in him shall not perish, but have eternal life." Now, given the systematic nature of the Bohemian art of dying, or otherwise known as the Ars Moriendi, I argue that this painting is actually capturing a specific moment in the ritual of securing a good death. I believe it is a visualization of the three nocturnes of the Midnight Virgil that was performed the evening preceding the funeral of the deceased. This would have included three psalms and three readings, predominantly taken from the Book of Job. These could have also been alluded to by the open book held by Saint Peter in the wall painting, and the bier the Virgin lies on could be seen as a confirmation of the fact that, according to the conventions of medieval death ritual, she is being transported to the graveyard on the grass depicted, ready to be buried in the prepared place, wrapped in a blue shroud. After the nocturnes, a funeral mass was said before the dead body, as it was surrounded by candles, and in the wall painting at Stary Swojanów, the apostles are painted with candles in their hands. Now, to return to the role of spatial partitioning, this Dormition scene is located in the chancel area, therefore its primary medieval viewers would have been members of the clergy. The fact that it is on the wall to the left of the altar and not behind the altar itself makes it even more difficult to see from the nave, as it is sort of tucked behind the corner. However, the medieval art of dying is also addressed, although differently, in the church's nave area in a wall painting that would have been easily visible to lay viewers. It acts as a kind of foil or opposite, perhaps, to the painting in the chancel area. The Dormition of the Virgin represents the so-called good death, the ideal death, the death that followed its proper ritual procedure, whereas the presence of the iconography known as the Triumph of Death in the nave represents the so-called bad death, or the mors improvisa, the sudden and unforeseen death. It was by observing the church interior in detail in person that the new discovery of the Triumph of Death was made, which was extremely exciting. So it's located beneath the Last Judgment in the uppermost portion of the nave wall on the left. The sharp, pointed edge of a grey, semicircular scythe can be discerned with the heads of a group of people above it. It can be compared to other Bohemian depictions of the Triumph of Death, such as at the Bromov charnel house in eastern Bohemia. The iconography typically contains a pale horse with a rider, who is a personification of death, followed by a figure likely resembling Hades, which references Revelation 6, and a scythe blade beheading the living. Near the scythe, a figure pours liquid into a vessel, harassed by a demonic being pulling at his or her hair, beside another individual stretching out their arm to receive the drink on offer at a banqueting table. Most of these elements survive at Starý Svojanov, but have hitherto gone unnoticed. Going back to the idea that we've alluded to earlier of the mobile viewer, the fact that the frescoes don't move, but people who view them do, which, as you've mentioned, has been explored by scholars such as Jacqueline Jung and also by Donald Cooper or Tina Borden, Kimberly Skelton, Michael Baxendall and Svetlana Alpers. The list goes on, but that's just to name a few. We can begin to understand why the Dormition of the Virgin and the Triumph of Death appear in these discrete locations. Though they do not move, the viewer does, yet the viewer's movement is also restricted according to their social standing. I argue that the Triumph of Death thus acted as a didactic warning to the laity to avoid the bad death and its consequences of being sent to purgatory or worse, hell. While the Dormition of the Virgin perhaps served as inspiration and prompted the clergy to contemplate Saint Peter, who appears in the scene and who was also the first priest, and seek to imitate him whilst ritually facilitating the good death.
I couldn't agree more actually with this argument and interpretation, because it does seem as though the clergy have access to an image which reinforces their role in death rituals, and the laity always need to be warned about the bad death. There's a lot to dive into here. This is a really rich description and a really nice comparison between these two frescoes. So we can just break it down and like go through some ideas that I had while you were speaking. What is the role of the senses actually, and the way through your description I'm imagining colors and just this visual delight or interest in the actual frescoes, but also the way they tap into other senses, be that with the sensors, which, you know, make me think of smell and incense, or even touch with people carrying the bier, like these ideas of people touching, or, you know, even in the Triumph of Death, we have people, I think you described, pulling hair. So the senses are also really brought into these frescoes. And then, of course, there's you moving through the space, which adds another dimension to it as well. And related to this idea about the senses that you might comment on, you've mentioned candles in the image. And this brings, of course, the idea of light within the actual church and the way that either the frescoes might change throughout the course of the day and night, and also how their images are animated, activated, changed by you holding a candle or just candle lights around it, smoke of incense, this kind of thing. So yeah, that's where I started off with your description.
I think that it definitely, as you've mentioned, it really does allude to pretty much all of the senses, actually, when we go through it systematically like that. As you were speaking, it just reminded me of the scholar Beth Williamson and her work on what she terms silent music in relation to multisensory medieval devotion, and how she recognizes the influence of the medieval understanding of Aristotle's psychology and the anatomical theories of Galen, which framed the sensus communis, in this case, that could be hearing or even singing as part of kind of the liturgy there, but using that as a vehicle to propel the so-called inner senses whilst viewing these pieces.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm familiar with her work. This is great to bring in here. And yeah, this idea between external and internal senses as well, and how exterior ones might be activated that then help with some kind of interior cogitation or something like that. And then that gets into memory and all sorts of things. This contemplation on, as you said, a good death and a bad death. And I'm very excited about this imagery of the triumph of death, because there are several types of medieval images that we get in wall paintings and prints and all sorts of media that contemplate the ideas of death and a good death. And it's very easy for people to write them off as being this kind of medieval morbidity, or that they're related to the Black Death. But in fact, many of these iconographies, like the Dance of Death, are in fact actually not related to the Black Death or the plague at all, with the exception of the Triumph of Death, where it is an iconography that develops directly after or as a result of the plague. And so I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on that. And just, I don't know the exact timing of this fresco. Obviously, we're talking about 14th century, so that makes sense with the plague. But I'm wondering if that might be part of this conversation on good and bad death.
Yeah, I think you could certainly say that. I think that when it comes to the fresco being dated to the 14th century, it's difficult to date it extremely exactly. But another historical event that was on my radar in relation to its completion was in 1336, when Pope Benedict the 12th, I think it was, issued the papal bull, the Benedictus Deus, addressing the doctrine of individual judgment of the soul according to its state at the time of death. And it stated that those who died without sin could see God's face instantly, but the sinful soul was immediately subject to torment and suffering in purgatory or hell. And reacting against the contemporary heresy, so-called heresy, that souls had to wait until after the last judgment to gaze at God's countenance, the bull extended Benedict's prior treatise, De statu animarum sanctorum ante generale iu. And so that drastically changed medieval Bohemian Ars Moriendi, or art of dying, practice and belief, because it caused priests to intensify preparations for the pressing threat of sudden death, as you mentioned, sudden death by the plague, perhaps, a danger that was even more prevalent at that time because of the plague, yes.
I think this is another really great context to bring in, because it also reinscribe some of these tensions we've described, or some of these partitions of the space, right? Where you have the clergy, maybe now this dormition is also a call to action, right? Like they're reaffirming their role within preventing a bad sudden death, making sure their flock, as it were, is prepared as possible. All of these things are happening around the same time, and they're all interrelated, and they all mutually reinforce each other. Do you mind talking a little bit about your personal experience of going through these in order, as it were, or like in an intentional, in their intended way?
Yes, sure. I'd be happy to. So I think that the first reaction when you enter a church is if especially when the walls are very high, your face kind of goes from bottom upwards, so you look kind of maybe first at eye level or a bit lower, and then your eyes start to ascend higher, looking up towards the ceiling. So you kind of have this vertical movement, is kind of what naturally happens. But then you also have the movement from the entrance towards the altar, so you are kind of progressively going through what scholars such as Lucy Donkin have spoken about, these kind of gradations of holiness. So you're similar to, in the Old Testament, the idea that there was the Holy of Holies in the temple. The closer you got to that, you were increasingly standing on holy ground. And so walking through the church today, you can try to imagine that same kind of hierarchy of space. But I think what's also interesting to consider is, just to bring in another layer, is this idea of time. Because when we walk through space, time is passing. And time is a very interesting concept to think about in relation to the Middle Ages when it comes to the different books of hours or the liturgical hours, and how that relates also to the art of dying and the Dormition of the Virgin. But in particular, if I were to refer to one example, the Church of St. James the Great, I mentioned earlier at Slaviatin, the one that was quite large, the scholar Andre Factor has talked about the paintings as medieval graphic novels or medieval comics, because you can see all of these windows. And so to answer your question about moving through the space, it's almost like you've got this huge comic in front of you that you're invited to read. Although that's quite a romantic idea and quite a nice description to think about, quite charming, I think that it's a little bit simplistic. But when I started to look at the specific details of one wall in particular at that church, the wall that was mainly looking at the life of the Virgin Mary, I noticed that one particular prop or part of each composition was the Virgin Mary's crown. And often the Dormition is paired with coronation imagery, because as she ascends to heaven, she also assumes the throne as Queen of Heaven, or assumes her status as Queen of Heaven. So chronologically, you have the Dormition and then the coronation. But in this particular fresco cycle, the Virgin Mary is shown wearing the crown at pretty much every stage of her life, apart from the Adoration of the Magi and perhaps one other earlier scene. But even on the flight to Egypt, she's wearing a crown, or she's holding a scepter in one hand and then Christ as a child in the other. So her rulership is related to her motherly disciplining of the Christ child as well, which is interesting. The fact that this crown reappears breaks down this argument of a strict chronological viewing of the work, because it acts as an anachronism, the crown, because she is, according to medieval belief, she is eternally the Queen of Heaven. So that means that when she becomes the Queen of Heaven, she passes outside of the realm of time. But we are still within the realm of time. But that's how this crown can keep reappearing, because it's these triggers that point you back to the eternal identity of the Virgin Mary.
What an enticing detail. you want to, in terms of describing it, you know, somewhat simply, yeah, you can go comic book, yeah, and you move through it and there's a progress. But even that is disrupted when we look closer and see these details. And then that sparks a conversation, both for us, but also I imagine for a medieval viewer, they're like, ah, yes, see the crown, because, yep, it's really great. It actually reminds me a lot of the typological thinking that you get in the Christian Middle Ages, of just everything having its sort of prefiguration and then its culmination. But here, the timeline gets murky, and I think in a very intentional way. So I love that. And you know, you've talked a lot today about these iconographies that seemingly, when you say the title of them, they're familiar to us as medievalists, right? You say the Dormition of the Virgin, the death of the Virgin, or you say the triumph of death, or the nativity, the annunciation. But then when you describe them to me, you add in these little things that are in these frescoes that make it like, well, you know, it's that iconography, but there's these little other details that make them quite special and very localized. And I guess for me, this brings up this question about the role or even the responsibility of medievalists to examine these frescoes, especially now. Obviously, we're some time away from it, but after the fall of the Iron Curtain, these are still largely unexplored. But here you are pointing out all these amazing details that I think could really disrupt this idea of like a consistency, I guess, if that makes sense.
Mm. Yes, I think it's definitely interesting to consider, you know, localized culture, because I'm often wary of the fact that in the study of the global Middle Ages, we become too much of, like, we generalize too much. We become generalists. And that is the danger, I think, when you have such a broad scope of inquiry, that you start to pay less attention to the smaller details. So I think that the way that we can kind of combat that, or at least how I've tried to, is to view the local examples as a part of that larger story, but also to just maintain or still give them their due attention as well, the dignity that is their due. But I think that what would also be interesting is, as time passes, and as you mentioned, as the political situations have changed in Europe, my hope is that Central European medieval art becomes more integrated into the discipline of art history. There are many hidden gems that are yet to be explored in depth. Maybe people might assume that it's quite a backwater territory and it's maybe not that relevant to other areas like Western Europe, but medieval societies symbiotically interacted with one another. So understanding Bohemia not only promises to be relevant for scholars working on Czech material, but also academics and other enthusiasts who are interested in the medieval world as a whole.
I couldn't say it better myself. This is exactly right. And I find that this is really resonating with me. I think that this is like a really optimistic way to end the episode. It's something to celebrate that these are never before been so accessible. And you definitely have a lot of work ahead of you, but I think I speak for our listeners and certainly for myself when I say that I'm really excited to see what you continue to do with these frescoes, these sites, and I'm hopeful for the field and the expansion of scholarship into more Central and Eastern Europe. Thank you so much for sharing your research with us today. And for our listeners, we're going to try to put in the show notes some recommended readings if you'd like to learn more about this topic. And we'll try to integrate some images as well.
Yes, thank you very much for having me, Reed. It was a pleasure.
This has been an episode of The Multicultural Middle Ages, an anthology-style podcast series sponsored by the Medieval Academy of America. Season 4 was produced by Will Beattie, Jonathan Correa-Reyes, Reed O'Meara, Logan Quigley, and me, Lauren Cantrell, with music by Anna O'Connell. For more information on the MMA podcast, follow the notes in the episode description and consider subscribing to keep up with the latest episodes. Thanks for listening.